It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you all over the Pacific Northwest on the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. But I get a special opportunity here because sitting in studio with me is Iraq War veteran Michael Connor Humphreys, but a lot of you may know him a little bit better for something he did some time ago. It was a motion picture, and the older version of that character was, of course, played by somebody else, but the young Forrest Gump was played by Michael Connor Humphreys. Michael, it's good to see you in person.
How's it going, Lars?
I'm sure you probably get tired of talking about your role in that movie all those years ago.
It depends on the circumstances. You know, it's kind of gone away a little bit over the years, but I kind of expect it to, whenever I come to a new place, to, you know, meet new people and have to kind of go through the story again, but that's fine with me.
Well, I was glad that you reached out to us because you grew up in Mississippi, but you've now moved to the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, I was saying I'm a big fan from our Super Talk station in Mississippi where we got you there, and I've been listening to
you
for years. And yeah, when I came out here, I just thought I couldn't pass up the opportunity to look you up. So,
well, and what brings you from, I mean, I was just in Mississippi, I don't know, a month ago or so, because I went down to do some things in Louisiana.
Right.
And my wife and I like to drive around when we got some time, and so we checked out Louisiana, Mississippi, and we've been down there before. It's a beautiful part of the country. What brings you all this distance to the Northwest?
Well, I'm actually here kind of exploring employment opportunities. I actually finished school in a few months, and I do international relations is what I've been studying. Kind of just going to get that done and see what I can do as far as a career around here. And honestly, just this part of the country is so beautiful. I just wanted to kind of have some new scenery. Mississippi's great in a lot of ways, but, you know, I've been seeing it for years. So
it is a beautiful part.
I want to try something different.
No, it's a beautiful part of the country.
It is.
Now, it's a little bit of a culture shock.
It is culture shock, yeah. And I kind of knew that. I've been out here before doing a little work several years ago, so I'm a little familiar with it already. But, yeah, I am coming from the opposite side of the country, and not just geographically, but in every way you could possibly imagine. But, yeah, I do enjoy the abundance and variety of culture here. So, you know, I find it cool that you just got a bunch of different ways of thinking and people expressing themselves around here, which is neat. So, but it's definitely different.
Well, your notoriety for that movie part that you played that so many people remember. I mean, that was a real cultural, that movie is the entirety of it, Peas and Carrots, is a cultural icon. But then you didn't say, well, now I'm going to be a Hollywood type. I'm just going to go to California. I'm going to seek out movie roles. You said, I'm going to go serve my country.
Yeah, and the thing with that, you know, obviously I was really young when I did the movie, and it was a really big one to be in, to only be in one movie, and that kind of thing does follow you around for your whole life. But I guess as a kid, my parents both, we didn't really at that time want to go spend years in L.A. trying to get into that industry where we were more comfortable where we were. So I thought I would look at that when I got older, and by the time I was old enough to start looking into that as a career, Iraq had started to happen, Afghanistan. I come from a military family, and I'd always kind of floated the idea of doing the Army. So about the time I was 18, 19, I decided to go ahead and join up, and I thought there wasn't possibly a better time to do it than, you know, while the wars were going on, so I could actually have some service in there.
Thank you for your service to America.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, tell people what you did. You took a tour in Iraq.
Yeah, I was Army, and I was stationed out of Germany, and then I did a tour in Iraq from 2006 to 2007 in Anbar, which, of course, you know, at that time,
dangerous.
Ramadi and everything. Yeah, that was like the big hot spot over there, still is. But, yeah, I was there for about a year and a half, and just at the high point of everything at that time. You know, that was that one phase of the war back then. Now they're in another phase. And it's kind of crazy because, like, the town that I was actually based out of, the place that I defended with my life, and I had friends die defending it, and I saw Iraqi soldiers die defending it, I actually watched that town on the news in 2014, 2015 get overrun by ISIL. I don't think they've even taken it back since then. If I'm not mistaken, it's HIT, which is to the west of Ramadi. I believe it's still under the control of the insurgency over there. So, I mean, it's hard to have been there and met the Iraqis in that town and actually have gotten to, you know, have personal relations with people and then know what's probably going on to them now. And you can't really put that stuff down when you come back, even years later.
What's your personal reaction to the idea that you did do that service? You put your life in harm's way to do that and accomplish all that was accomplished. I mean, in 2011, even President Obama, who I was not a fan of, said, this is a success story. We have a self-governing country.
Right.
And then we pulled all the troops out and it all went back into
a
mess.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's two different sides to it. It's that the whole question of whether we should have been there to begin with is one thing, and that to me is kind of invalid at this point, because now that we're there, regardless of whether or not we should have been, you know, you got to have the right strategy. You can't pull everybody out in a situation like that. It's going to get unstable. It's like that everywhere in the Middle East, but they really probably should have kept more people in there for the time being. But I do understand the political dynamics. You know, the American population, for the most part, wanted out. But most people are not that well informed about what's going on to begin with, you know, to make those kinds of decisions. So, yeah, there's a lot of political motivation that went on that got us out of there. And it's just kind of going the same way as it did in Vietnam or Afghanistan after the Russians or any of these other places. It takes so much time and investment to bring a place to a point of stability. And compromise, too, which you don't have a lot of that, especially when you get into foreign policy and stuff, military policy. It's people are pretty hard line about which way they're going to go with it. So
I'm talking to Michael Connor Humphreys, who you might remember from Forrest Gump, who played the young Forrest Gump. So what was your MOS when you were there?
Infantry. Yeah. Yeah. I was only in there for about 3 to 4 years, the minimum stint. And I figured if you're going to be in the military, you might as well do like the hardest job there is or the most basic job. So be on the front lines. But yeah, I hesitate to say I enjoyed it, because there's a lot of things that are not enjoyable, but it was probably the funnest thing I've ever done. And really, having done movies is great and all, but I really consider having been in the military the most significant thing I've ever done overall, you know, that's had the biggest impact. But yeah,
well,
Michael, it
won't surprise you to hear that almost all the veterans I talk to do say they liked being in the military. They did describe it as fun, no matter which conflict they were in the middle of.
Yeah, it's true. And I'm glad to be pursuing what I'm pursuing now, but I do regret every day not being in there anymore. And it's just, you know, the camaraderie and the professionalism. There's a number of things that draw me to it, but you know, I almost made career out of it. But there's a couple other things I want to try out too.
Okay, so let me ask you this: when you go into the military, and then I know you do basic, then you do your MOS training, then you get assigned to where you're going.
Right.
When you show up, do you let people just figure out who Michael Connor Humphreys is? Or do you figure it's better just to say, by the way, I had this thing in my past, or what?
My approach to that, generally speaking, I have avoided attention most of my life with that thing. That's just been my rule. And I knew when I was going in the Army that would be there would be a trick to avoiding that. So I just didn't say anything. I was about 3 weeks into basic training, and one of the drill sergeants figured it out eventually. And the kicker is that there was this one kid in there for the first 3 weeks who kept coming up to me, and he's like, you know, you look just like that kid that was in Forrest Gump. And I kept telling him, I was like, oh, I get that all the time, man. I was like, you know, I just happen to look like him. That's not me, though. And then he never believed a word I said after that once he actually found out. So, and then he thought I was an elf in the Lord of the Rings or something. I couldn't convince him otherwise. So,
did the drill sergeant go to IMDb or something and look up your name?
You know,
or
I'm not sure how they picked it up. I think somebody just put two and two together with my face, or maybe there was somebody there that, like, you know, passed the word around. But once it got out, you know, it made basic training interesting. They're already hard on you anyway, so it didn't make it any tougher. But the rest of the time I was in the military, you know, I had my nickname assigned to me automatically.
What was your name?
Just Gump.
Gump?
You know, yeah. And they already call people Gump anyway, so. But,
So you didn't have any DIs telling you, run, Michael, run.
No, you know, they were actually pretty good about it. The thing is, they already yell run for us, run at people anyways. I mean, it's such a big, you know, iconic joke that always made me look behind, you know, look over my shoulder whenever I heard that, thinking, oh, they had figured me out. But they were just yelling that at people to begin with. So, but yeah, they were fair about it. You know, like I said, they were no tougher than they already were going to be. And nobody else in the military was either. But generally, I got a lot of respect from people for it, which was cool. Yeah, I think it was a benefit overall to have put those two things together. I think I've probably, any attention I've ever been able to bring to the military through that, I thought was helpful, and that's what I would like to do with it, you know, help out veteran situations in any way I can. So,
Michael, do you mind sticking around for a few minutes?
Oh, absolutely.
Michael Connor Humphreys is with me. You're listening to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Michael Connor Humphreys has joined me in studio. A young man who grew up in Mississippi, the pride of Independence, Mississippi. So a great town to be from, huh?
Yeah, it's actually, yeah, Independence is where I grew up. I was born in Memphis. And,
okay.
Yeah, but all small town, North Mississippi originally. And that's where, you know, most of my home life over the years has been around that area. But I've lived all over, worked all over. So I've had a lot of experience outside of Mississippi. And that's kind of what brings me to places like this.
The young Forrest Gump. And you've been in some indie movies since then, or one?
Yeah, generally speaking, there's Forrest Gump, of course, is the big one. And then I've done a bunch of smaller work here and there over the years, music videos, commercials and stuff like that. Like I was saying, I didn't take it that seriously as a kid. It's hard to get a kid to take that stuff seriously. So, I had a independent film, World War II film, that I actually shot out here in Portland a few years ago, Pathfinders. And so I've been out here off and on working on that, or had been at one time. And that was a good experience. I got some directing experience with that, production experience. I was kind
directing.
Of directing. Yeah, I was on the creative end of that one. So I did play a role in it as well, but, you know, which was easy for me playing a soldier, obviously. But they let me get a little bit of directing experience out of that. And then I've done some Broadway style shows, DC, LA, with some bigger names. If All the Sky Were Paper, that was a show where we actually read war letters. This Andrew Carroll, this military historian, went around the world and collected war letters from basically every army and every war that's ever happened, and got these letters and then wrote all these sketch pieces around the letters, like a guy trapped in a ship at Pearl Harbor, or this Russian soldier fighting Germans, or something like that. And we did a show at the Kennedy Center, did a show at the Kirk Douglas in L.A. So, and a lot of this stuff, it's funny because I haven't really pursued it so much as people just kind of hunt me down out of the blue a lot of the time when I'm not expecting it to do things like this, which is great. So I've always figured if I were to actually put a little more effort into it myself, you know, I could probably get somewhere with it. But I know Portland's a good area to kind of look into that stuff. I know they have a really good theater scene around here.
Now, what do you want to do? You want to do something creative?
Yeah, I do. And it's my passions go two radically different directions. You know, acting is something, and movie making I obviously fell into as a kid. And I do really enjoy it, and, you know, have a lot of creative drive with that. Would like to pursue it a bit on the other side of it, like with the military and whatnot. I'm also extremely passionate and knowledgeable with foreign affairs, international relations, military history. I waste a lot of time reading about history and geopolitics, you know, when I should be doing something else. And that's a strange thing to waste your time doing. But there's some way to, you know, turn that into something productive, of course, if, you know, you go down the right avenues with it. But, and that's what I study in school too, is international relations. So that's a very different direction than film. But once I finish up with that, I'm going to see what I can do as a career with that, and wholeheartedly pursue anything in the entertainment industry simultaneously.
So, Mike, where are you finishing up your schooling?
It's I'm online, American Military University. Yeah, American Military University. It's through the Army originally. Yeah, it's where one of the places where a lot of people that are active duty that want to go to school have to go online. Generally, you don't really have brick and mortar schools you can go to when you're getting restationed.
And you don't need it either.
No, you don't. And, you know, everything nowadays, you can pretty much do anything online, anything and everything. I would wager to say that, you know, in probably a decade, you're going to have more people in online schools than you'll have at brick and mortars, just because it's more convenient for a lot of folks. But also feel a little trepidation too about the fact that the entire world's slipping into the internet. But, you know, that's just the way technology goes. I don't know if you can do anything about it.
I've got a brand new grandbaby at home, and one of the scariest things for me is that every time a screen, a phone screen or a pad screen,
yeah,
gets anywhere, if she sees it, she gravitates
wants to
it.
To,
and
like,
she's 15.
Yeah.
She started at about 6 months. She'd start grabbing for any screen, and I thought, it's a really nice device. It's a great tool,
right,
but it's a little frightening to be that sort of obsessed,
yeah,
with it.
And I went in to help at a kindergarten not too long ago back in Mississippi, volunteer work, and all the 5-year-old kids have iPads, every one of them. And I was just, it was blowing my mind, because that's not what it was like, obviously, when I was there, you know, 20 something years ago. And I'm not even technologically adept to use these things like these 5-year-olds are. I'm just old enough that, like, the social media, internet, Facebook, YouTube, all that stuff started hitting when I was in my early 20s, and I was just old enough that I would participate in it, but also didn't care that much. So now I find myself kind of like out of touch with that stuff a little bit, more so than I probably should be. But, you know, I'm slowly working my way back into it. It's,
well, Michael, for those people listening and for people who hear this interview, we have a lot of podcasters who,
yeah,
who listen and will hear it later. If they email me,
mm-hmm,
talk@LarsLarsen.com, What would you like to get? What would be your ideal job? Because I'll throw the hook out there and see if we can find something.
Here in the long short term, finishing up school, like I said, I got the international relations degree. Anything involving international business and sales in general. I've always wanted to work in the defense industry. There's a couple of those things. Lockheed Martin's up here, right? Yeah. Right, guys like that. You know, military experience probably falls into that, and then. This one, it's a little ironic, but I guess this is where life imitates art. But you got the whole Forrest Gump Nike running shoes and all that he wears in there, and the whole running thing that he does. I never intended to work at a shoe store, but I actually spent the past couple of years while I was working on school working at a shoe store in the athletics department.
You did?
Got to know everything there is to possibly know about running shoes. And, of course, people are coming in there knowing who I am, too, so it all just kind of falls together.
Maybe
and
you should hit the people up at
Nike. Yeah, that's one of the things I thought about. But I've become kind of an unintentional expert on athletic gear and, you know, and fitness and all that kind of stuff, hiking, running. So, but, pretty in touch with the running shoe industry these days.
Well, I'll tell you what. Well, I will pass along any emails that come to me with people offering things up to you, because it's great that you've come here to the Northwest. And I kind of like the fact that I meet some people, and I tend to be kind of, you know, in my industry, and I'm kind of focused on that. But I'm 58 years old.
Yeah.
I like the fact that you see the diversity of things. You're saying, well, I can be in the military, I can be in the movies, I can do an indie film, I can be a director, I can maybe be a Foreign Service officer, or maybe someday an ambassador, or I could work for a shoe company.
Having a little bit of experience in everything, I've always put a premium on that, you know, and maybe that's kind of bounced around a lot over the years, but I feel like I've gotten to do a lot in my 32 years that a lot of people probably don't get to do in their whole lives, so...
And which you're going to climb Mount St. Helens at some point.
Yeah, I'll get to that here soon, yeah.
Listen, you should do it while you're your age, because because that was my experience. Was it's a little physically it's not as bad as climbing Mount Hood.
Yeah.
And certainly not as bad as Mount Rainier. Mount Rainier is a tough task.
So many volcanoes around here.
Lots of volcanoes.
How often do they get evacuated? I don't guess that's something that actually goes down that often.
No.
I haven't heard about it on the news any time in my lifetime. So.
Although Mount Rainier... The big one you can occasionally see from Portland, but it's a beautiful mountain. But they say that about 500 years ago, a big slab of it slid off into the Ording Valley and pushed out the edge of Puget Sound, where Tacoma is now. And I asked the geologist, how often does that happen? He said, about every 500 years. So
rolls around every half millennium.
You may want to go after it while you can. Right. Michael, do you have a website or a Facebook or anything you want to share or not?
I've got an email address. It's michaelconnorhumphreys@gmail.com.
Very good.
Yep.
And then there's probably a private one so you can screen out of.
I have a couple of different windows for that.
Michael, it's a pleasure. Thanks so
you
much.
You as well, Lars.
And thanks
appreciate
for your service
it.
To America. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the program. A pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails shortly, but it is with great pleasure that I welcome to the program Ron Schneider, who is the author most recently of Out of Our Heads, The Rolling Stone, The Beatles, and Me. Mr. Schneider, thanks a lot for taking the time tonight.
My pleasure.
You've had quite a history with rock and roll. I mean, between the Beatles connection and the Rolling Stones and then working at Apple Records, it seems like maybe you were the Forrest Gump of rock and roll. You were in the right place at the right time all the time. Am I overstating that?
Well, I also was with ABCO, which had Bobby Vinton, Neil Sedaka, and Sam Cooke, so you aren't overstating it at all.
How in the world did you find yourself in this position? So there you are in the mid-1960s, and you go from being a college student to being a rock and roll manager?
Well, my mother's brother was Alan Klein, and in the true interests of nepotism, I started working up in New York with him to begin with, and that's how it all
started. So why did he bring you on board? Why did he think you had what it took to kind of... Well, be the backstage guy, the money man, and the guy who could sit with these even at the time, big time rock and rollers, and manage to try to keep them in line to some extent, or just go along for the ride.
Well, it was just luck and timing. In reality, I was a Miami boy, so I grew up in Miami. I was more laid back. So when I got to all them, I wasn't New York flash. They appreciated, I think, that I was a regular guy. So my uncle first took me under his wing and brought me with Neil Sedaka and Bobby Vinton, cool guys. And what happens is he realized I don't have that celebrity worshiping gene. I basically treat everybody the same. So when he saw that, he knew he could depend on me not to get all fawning over some talent. And that's how I first started. And the talent appreciates it, too. They're sick of people always doing whatever they want. So they like the fact that they had a guy who was independent working for the guy that was managing their money. And that's why I think it all started.
So tell me this. What was, once you were working for the Stones for a period of time, what was your daily routine like when you were on out on the road with them?
Well, on the road, it was simple. It was easy. First, get on the plane, go to the next date, do the date. And then usually the best idea would be we'd get done with the date about 1 o'clock in the morning, fly to our next venue, go out and eat greasy spoon food, and then 2 o'clock have a sound check, then about 6, 7 o'clock go to the show. And that's what it was. It was day in, day out of going like that when you're on the road for, you know, a month and a half. It just blends into, you know, like it just get up, go to work, get up, go to work. And that's about it. You hardly sleep.
Now, the only challenging part of that, I would think, looking at it from the outside, Mr. Schneider, is that when you get done with the, you know, you get done with the date that you're playing and it's 1 o'clock in the morning and the band members say, hey, let's go drink for a while or do other things before we go get on that plane. Did you ever have problems with that?
No, it was mainly, it wasn't let's go for a drink. Everybody, about 2 o'clock in the morning, most towns where we were going to in the 60s, remember, they were closed. There was no bars open that we would go to. The only thing that would be open would be the greasy spoon. We would actually try and, we would carry our own bottles of liquor. So, you know, the guys would have that. But in reality, it was so much work. It wasn't that much playing around. In fact, they didn't mess around with groupies or anything as much because they were creating music. And it was just caught up on trying to make some money. They were broke at the time when I was first working with them all.
They were broke. How broke is broke when you're a rock and roll star?
Well, broke is you can't afford drugs. Broke is the fact that you can't buy a house, you can't do anything. I mean, they really were just starting to make money, and they were, at the beginning, until we took over, the victims of the record companies, which just took advantage of everybody. You know, they would go in front of them and say, you want to be a rock and roll star? Okay, we're taking everything, but we'll let your record play. So that was the problem with that.
Yeah, and the problem is that at what point does the band start objecting to the fact that they're doing all this work and working these fairly long schedules where you're going city to city to city, and you're not seeing much of anything at the end of that?
Well, I left Abco in 1969, and the Stones came to me and asked me to do the tour in 69 in August. And it was funny because the first thing they said to me is, we're sick of doing all these tours and having nothing. Ronnie, you have to promise us at the end of the tour you'll give us some cash. So that's what we did.
Now, in that position, did you you had to be the kind of the enforcer on this? If they were promised a portion of the gate or a portion of the, I know these days they make a lot of money selling things at the concert venue, but I don't know if that was as much the case at the time. But you were the guy who had to make sure that the money actually got back to the band members or got stuffed in an account somewhere so they actually would have some money left at the end of the tour?
That's exactly what I did, and it was interesting because I sometimes was carrying $30,000 or $40,000 on me because we'd go to a date and I'd pick up the cash at the date and go to another one. So that part was always interesting, and you know, having that much money. But luckily, I'm a like short, little, chunky guy. I didn't look like I had any money anyhow.
So you didn't have to work at being incognito.
No, I was very incognito. I was the guy with the short hair with those guys with long hair, and I was the guy in the suit.
Now, how did they regard you then, since you were sort of, I mean, visually, culturally different than them?
When I first met them, we all got along. We're about the same age. So culturally, it was interesting. They took to all the horrible things I taught them from when I graduated the University of Miami. I did all those horrible pranks at all college guys do, and they joined in. So we all got along well on that, and then they began trusting me because also another thing's happened is that every now and then you get into fights because, you know, people are always challenging the talent one way or another when we did go to those bars. And if you're willing to stand there and fight next to a guy who's your friend, you know that, you know, you're bound together, and that's how it all started out, I think. They knew I was on their side.
I'm talking to Ron Schneider, who's the author most recently of Out of Our Heads, The Rolling Stones, The Beatles, and Me. You were in the room when The Beatles broke up?
Well, they broke up a little after, but I was there when it was all happening. And what I can say about that is probably 99% of the world has it totally wrong.
Really?
Yoko did not. Yeah, Yoko didn't break up the Beatles. I mean, now Paul even admits that, and they say it. In fact, the funny thing is, when we first started working with them, the person that was most difficult at that time was Linda Eastman. She wanted her, you know, Linda was with Paul, and she wanted her family, John Eastman and Lee Eastman, to manage the Beatles. So that was the first problem we had. Then the next thing to understand is everybody thinks it was those things that broke up the Beatles. I think more than likely it's life, you know, like any, it's like a marriage. You all get along, everything's really great, and then time, you all age differently, and you part your ways, and that's actually probably what happened more so than anything. And you have strong individuals. John Lennon, Paul McCartney, and George Harrison were not wimpy guys. They basically, you know, they stood up for what they believed in, they fought for what they believed in, and I have to sit there and say that I was always proud of working with them. They weren't, you know. None of these guys took them. One of the things about big talent that lasts forever, you got to realize, they never take themselves seriously. They don't pay attention to the press. If you listen to what the press says, you're going to die.
No doubt. Well, and look, as a conservative, I've got to admire some of it. I mean, the song Revolution is a pretty darn conservative song, and so is Taxman.
Oh, Taxman for sure.
I mean, you know, you want a revolution? Show me the plan. And I don't think they thought too much of Abbie Hoffman because of things like that. Listen, I'm going to enjoy reading the book. Ron, it is a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. You enjoy.
Yeah, thank you very much. Ron Schneider, who is the author of Out of Our Heads, The Rolling Stones, The Beatles, and Me. He worked at Apple Records, at ABCO, and he was there at the time of the breakup of the band. And no, it wasn't Yoko that got it done. Glad to get your phone calls and emails at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarsen.com. Well, the left keeps screaming about impeachment. What they really mean, perhaps, is the C word, more like a coup d'etat. We will talk to the managing editor of The Stream coming up next about whether or not we should be calling the left's impeachment talk what it really is, and that is a coup aimed at the administration of Donald Trump. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails, and some of the emails are crazy about this ex-gender that the Department of Motor Vehicles is considering making the change to allow you to not identify yourself as a male or as a female, but merely as X, and the implications for car insurance and other issues. Let me go to a JR, who is an insurance agent, Eugene. JR, do you sell car insurance?
I do, Lars. Good afternoon. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Good afternoon. I'm glad you made the call because I needed somebody in the business. Now, if you sell car insurance, are some of your clients 16 and 17 and 18-year-old young men and women?
That is correct. I just want to clarify that I write insurance. I don't sell it.
Okay.
Everybody has insurance. Everybody comes to me for different reasons.
I see. So if you're selling to a 16-year-old young lady, does she pay a lower rate for the same, you know, same car, same coverage than a young man? Does the young man pay more?
Yes, and let me elaborate just a little bit. The fallacy here is that people can compare insurance by saying, oh, I pay this much and you pay that much, and when in fact it's impossible to compare people's premiums. And the reason is very simple. The insurance carrier's rate on risk, and that's based on actuarial tables that you and I would never understand unless we were deep in the insurance world.
Right.
A number of those factors that they rate on are based on location, well, at least in regards to auto insurance, location, type of vehicle, credit, motor vehicle driving history, loss history. That includes age as well. There's just no way to compare price, but when it comes to gender, I will tell you for a fact that, yes, males are a riskier gender, and the insurance carriers rate them appropriately.
All right. Let's say you have two twins walk in, one male, one female, same family, exactly the same age. One was born 5 minutes ahead of the other one, and they are both from the same family, and they're going to be driving the same cars, and they live in the same location. How much difference is there going to be between the young man and the young woman?
I have never had that situation come across my desk.
but you could someday.
You're absolutely correct.
I'm trying to get to apples and apples, except now we're talking X's and Y's, right?
Well, yes, Absolutely. But to answer your question as best as I can, based on my experience, my gut would be that if all the criteria were identical other than gender, I would say that the male would probably be paying at least an average of 20% to 30% more in premium. And of course, this depends on location by zip code.
Let's assume both of the twins are 16 and they live in the same zip code.
No, but that's what I was getting at. Yeah. And a more generalized answer is those same twins, if they lived in a different zip code, the percentage difference could be greater or less.
Right. So let me ask you this. Can you insist that the young man or woman identify by a gender for insurance rating purposes?
I don't know how well this is going to go over with
people. I'm trying to get a movement going where every 16-year-old kid who wants to drive. Now, when I was a kid, everybody who was 15 and 3/4 couldn't wait to get their driver's license. I understand these days with millennials, it's fashionable not to do that for some reason, although it seems crippling when it comes to your ability to get around and go to a job or go to interviews for anything else. But if I could get a whole groundswell of young men to come in and identify as X, that the insurance industry would go to Salem and say, you got to change this back. We need to know if they're boys or girls.
Well, I tuned in a little late, and I heard something about DMV, but I never heard anything about the insurance commissioner. Is this coming out of the insurance commissioner's
office or DMV? No. DMV is going to throw you a curve here. Here's the story from today. The Department of Motor Vehicles is considering adding another gender option on the Oregon Driver's License app. Non-binary gender would be the third option for those who do not identify as male or female. The option would appear as X in the application. And apparently when DMV took this to a hearing at the crazy building with the big gold bowling trophy on top, what they heard was everybody was really enthusiastic about the idea of young men and women who say they want an X there instead of an M or an F on the gender designation. So when a parent calls up and says, hey, I need to add my 16-year-old to our auto insurance, and you answer the phone, JR, and you say, okay, tell me, a date of birth, name, and the name of one of the people who testified is Oblio Stroyman of Transponder. That's the name of one of the people who testified. So you can tell that this is taken very seriously because Oblio Stroyman of Transponder showed up in Salem to testify on this. And you say, okay, is this a young man or woman? And mom or dad says, X. Not male or female, X. And you aren't allowed to inquire as to what's, behind their belt buckle or under their zipper. So what do you do?
Well, I will say this, Lars, that I would make the suggestion that you have your staff make a phone call to the insurance commissioner's office and get a general ruling on how they feel about this, because I do not believe DMV has authority to dictate to all the insurance carriers that are doing business here via the Oregon Insurance Commissioner's office. You're going to put an X on the phone.
No, they don't have the authority. Well, actually, the way I understand this story, let me see. I think this was mentioned in there that they do not have to have this. Let's see. I think they indicated that they do not have to have this approved by the legislature. This, because remember, the DMV does a lot of its business through administrative rules. They don't have to have the kind of like Obama did, where he didn't need the Congress to pass laws. The president just signed a piece of paper and made new laws by doing that. Apparently, the DMV does the same kind of thing here.
I think they're setting up a battle between DMV and the Oregon Insurance Commissioner's office personally, because this is going to pose a lot of problems.
Now, JR, I hope this sparks a lively conversation at your next insurance meeting.
I guarantee it will, Lars.
You
it's
take
been a pleasure
care.
And thank you for the good news.
Hey, what's the name of your insurance agency? We got to give you a plug.
Hayes Insurance Group in Eugene.
Hayes Insurance Group. There you go. Thank you. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I can't tell you how much I've been looking forward to talking to Gunnery Sergeant R. Lee Ermey, who is the author of The Gunny, but You know him from motion pictures. You know him from some very funny television commercials. Gunnery Sergeant Ermey, it's great to have you on the program.
Semper Fi, Lars. It's good to be there. Thanks for having me.
Listen, as I'm about halfway through the book, and I'm really enjoying it. Before we get to the book, I want you to talk a bit about how you got to the position you're in as this icon for Americans. When they see you show up, they understand that this is a drill instructor, and he's not going to take any quarter. He is in charge, and he's going to tell you how it's going
to
be.
Well, I have to tell you, Lars, basically, growing up, my father was a World War II vet, an old Navy guy, and we grew up on a farm west of Kansas City, and he taught us work ethics. And I'm a firm believer that we learn well because the greatest training tool in the world is pain, and the second greatest training tool is fear. And he was the fastest draw on his belt that I've ever seen. And he could bend us over and make us wish we had never screwed up. But work ethics, as far as I'm concerned, is what it's all about. You know, I didn't graduate high school. The judge told me that I needed to go in the military, and I was 17 at the time. So I did finish high school in the Marine Corps. I took the GED test, passed with flying colors. So I don't like to hear these whiners complain that they're where they are, they're on unemployment and drawing welfare checks because they have their disadvantaged education. I don't like to hear that. I could lose my job today, and I'm a firm believer by the end of the day, I would have another damn job, and I would be working. I might not get, it wouldn't be the bank president, but it would be a job, and I would get a paycheck. And that's the important thing to me. My family will profess, and they will tell you that they have never missed a meal, and they've always had a warm place to sleep and a roof over their heads. I take great pride in that. And the book is about how to take command of your life, get off welfare, unemployment, food stamps, regain a small amount of your self-respect.
You're listening to the absolutely fantastic voice of Gunnery Sergeant R. Lee Ermey, the author of Gunny's Rules. I want you to tell me, why do you suppose it is that America has lost its work ethic for many people? Not all, but for many.
We've lost our self-respect. That's how we've done it. I mean, how many people have their doggone hands out for freebies today? And, of course, the government, be they left or right, are right there to accommodate these people because they want that boat. And if they give them something free, in other words, buy that boat, that's the way it works. And what a shame it's come down to that. You know, I can remember, Lars, when I was a kid, we started our day off with the Pledge of Allegiance. Now, I'm a Methodist. I don't care if you're a Buddhist, a Catholic, a Hindu, or a Muslim. I have tremendous respect for you. Why is it that radical Muslims, they're so thin-skinned, they want to kill us, for Pete's sakes? I mean, come on. So we can't put our children can't put their right hand over their heart in this country anymore in the schoolroom and give the pledge to the country that has provided all of this, the schoolroom, to them? Because, God forbid, if there happens to be a Muslim in there or a Hindu or an atheist, my God, that would probably hurt their feelings really bad, you know? But the thing is, nobody requires that Muslim or that Hindu or that Catholic or whatever, the Buddhist or whatever it might be. Nobody requires him to stand up, and all it takes. So I feel uncomfortable because the word God is mentioned. So I complain, and because one person complains, not one kid in the entire school can say the pledge. Wait a minute. I used to think that it was majority rules.
I thought so, too. It should still be there. I want to take you back to the beginning of your career, though, in the Marines, because if things had worked out differently, your original plan to read from The Gunny, your book, was to stay in the Marines for a full career. You might have become the top sergeant for the United States Marine Corps, but then there was that rocket attack in Da Nang, wasn't it?
Yeah, they call him the Sergeant Major of the Marine
Sergeant
Corps.
Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps. I'm sorry. I should have remembered that, but I appreciate you reminding me. But what happened that changed your whole life plan for a career in the military?
Well, not a problem. You know, if it wouldn't have been for that rocket attack, I would have stayed in the Marine Corps for 30 years. That means I would have been out about 20 years ago, and I would have started my career then. So basically, it would have set me back about 18 years.
I love the way you tell that story, because the rocket attack comes in. The bunker that you're inside of that's supposed to protect you, one of the big beams comes down right square on your shoulder, and there you are, all busted up. You walk down to the aid station. You finish the story.
Yeah, I walked. I didn't. They call it the sick bay.
Yeah.
I walked down to sick bay. And there must have been 25 people down there, and they were all bleeding, and there were only about three or four corpsmen. And so, I felt, what the heck, I'm not hanging out down here and waiting. And so I went back to the hooch, had a couple of shots of old granddad, pulled the other staff NCOs together in the hooch, and we put that shoulder back in place. Well, that's the old bite the bullet thing. You know how that works, Lars. I mean, I was already in pain, so, a couple of shots, old granddad does wonders. And you've seen it in every cowboy movie you ever saw.
Absolutely.
You bite down on this piece of rawhide.
Yeah.
And you go, ooh, as the boys twist and grind on the shoulder. But they got it back in place. The problem was, after that, it would never stay in place. BuMed came, that was back in 72, we were winding Vietnam down, mm-hmm. back in that stage of the game. And if you had a scratch, you were going to be retired or put out of the Marine Corps or let go. I was over 10 years, so it was obvious I was a career Marine. The Marine Corps is pretty good. They love their Marines, and we take care of one another. The Navy takes care of us as well, and they're not just going to... Adios, amigo. That's not right. After I've served almost 12 years of dedicated service, but I don't want to be. The way I feel about it, and I'm really upset about this because I really don't want to be a socialist.
Yeah.
And I really don't want to live in a socialist country. I'm becoming very, very obsessed with the way this country's headed.
Yep.
And like I was saying, we got the one atheist is going to complain, so the entire classroom or the entire school doesn't, none of them get to say the Pledge of Allegiance. When I go to Japan and I travel a lot, I'm the first to get up there and rub Buddha's belly. I respect everybody's religion. If it's prayer time, I'll get on my knees with them. It doesn't make any difference. Why is everybody else different? Why are they so thin-skinned that just the mere mention of God upsets these people?
Doesn't make any sense.
I guess that just shows how rude I am, that no. I would think of mentioning God in the presence of somebody of another religion. I guess that's the one-way street that I go down.
They should all be a little more tolerant. I'm talking to Gunnery Sergeant Arlie Ermey, the author of The Gunny. You know him from Full Metal Jacket. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It is my great pleasure to have with me the man you know from television, from the movies, and now from a book, Gunnery Sergeant Arlie Ermey, former Marine Corps drill instructor, and his new book called Gunny's Rules. We'll get to the life lessons of that, but would you please describe for people the unique position you hold? If I understand right, you're the only man to be advanced in rank after your retirement. Now, how did that happen?
The Marine Corps retired me early. I was going to stay for 30 years, and I got injured, and I found myself standing outside the gate of the Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego with my little green sea bag by my side. That's everything I owned in this world was in that bag. So anyway, I was thinking, I grew up on a small farm in Kansas, west of Kansas City, about 18 miles. That nearest neighbor was about a mile away, so we didn't have any neighbor kids to play with. There were six boys in my family, so I had five brothers that we played with. We were all a year apart. But I really didn't have any outside friends, so I got to thinking, I was standing out there outside the base, and I thought, every doggone friend that I've ever had in my life is back here on that base, and it bothered me. So I just kept showing up for work, basically, is the way it works. Marine Corps retired me, and I kept showing up for work. And after a while, they came to accept me. I never really left the Marine Corps. I've been with the Marine Corps. I've been to Afghanistan and Iraq and all over the Middle East. I go over 2 weeks at a time. I don't stay in the green zone. The Marine Corps will put me in a helicopter, give me a crew, and they will take me all over the combat zone. And there's nothing quite like jumping up on the hood of a Humvee and getting everybody to form a semicircle around you and getting them to laugh at your corny joke. And the thing is, Lars, you know they're pretty hard up for jokes over there. They're pretty hard up for a laugh. So you get them to laugh at nearly anything.
I heard that on one, I think it was Mail Call, you'd wrapped up a shooting, you'd wrapped up a week of shooting or a couple of weeks of shooting for Mail Call, and the rest of the Hollywood crew was heading back home, and you said, no, I'm putting on a flak jacket and jumping on a helicopter and going out to some of the little teeny FOBs that nobody ever bothered to visit.
I stayed there for a couple of weeks. I'm out in the middle of the combat zone, and I'm talking to these old beat-up Marines. They're tattered, and they're beat up, and they're bloody, and they've lost quite a number of their fellow Marines to combat. And I'm talking to them. I'm on a one-on-one basis, and I'm living with them. You know, I sleep in the same sleeping bag right next to them. So I eat the same MRE. They were telling me that they heard a while back that Schwarzenegger was coming over, is what they said. And then one of them piped up from in the back and said, yeah, but Gunny, I think we seen his airplane go over. He didn't come out here, but we got to see his airplane. I thought, well, yeah, that's the Bob Hope thing, you know, because Bob Hope, God bless his heart, did what he could to entertain the troops, but, you know, he did it in the rear with the gear, way in the rear with the gear, to the point where the only people that got to attend the Bob Hope show was the people that worked in supply. It was what a shame that was, because I had all the respect in the world for Bob Hope, but they wouldn't let him come out in the combat zone where he was really needed. Those are the guys that need to be entertained. They're the ones that need a little comic relief, a little something to brighten up their lives, not the guys in supply that are back in the rear with the gear having hot chow every day. It's important to me when I go over, I put the flak jacket on and I go out right out where the troops are.
Gunnery Sergeant, I want you to tell the story that you tell in the book just a bit. I want people to buy the book because it's a fantastic read. But not only do you have one heck of a work ethic, you're also willing to take risks. And risk takers have always been the ones who moved ahead. And you would take risks. I know you were getting a little tiny check from the military after your 10 years of service and getting busted up in your shoulder and everything else, but it wasn't much of anything. But a guy who'd hop on a plane and fly off to, Okinawa, and if I recall correctly, you showed up with a couple of $100 in your pocket, and you managed to turn that into a bar and then eventually into a hotel. That might surprise some people who've seen you on television and think, well, he's a fine actor, but he's also an entrepreneur.
Well, when I left Okinawa, I had heard that one of my customers came in one evening and told me that they had heard that they were going to start shooting Vietnam War shows over in the Philippine Islands.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I sold everything that I owned in Okinawa, sold out to my partner, and I went down to Kadena Air Force Base, and I jumped on Space A, and I went to the Philippine Islands. I was going to get involved in the film industry. I always wanted to do that, and I did stand-up comedy after I left the Marine Corps. So I went to L.A., and I was up on the stage doing stand-up comedy. I will guarantee you one thing, I did not have any hecklers.
In fact, you knew how to take care of a heckler with the drill instructor.
I sure did. And so now I find myself on the airplane heading out to the Philippine Islands. The beautiful thing with me is I was single. So I didn't have a family to worry about, a family to support. And I was single, so I could do these things. I mean, a guy can always support himself. I mean, if I have to eat out of the dipsy dumpster, well, so be it. But I could not ever ask the wife and family to do that.
Yeah.
But now, this time, when I left Kadena Air Force Base and flew over to the Philippine Islands, I had that same sea bag by my side. But guess what? It was full of money now. And I went over, and the first thing I did was create a business, because they said, well, the films won't be coming over for a year or so. So I bought a fishing troller. And I went into the fishing business, and I was very successful. I hired a crew, a Filipino crew, and they ran the boat. I went out with them about probably three times a week. When I got busy with film, I gave that fishing boat to the captain and the crew. I didn't have the heart to pull the plug on their livelihood. So I gave him the boat, the nets, the whole ball of wax. I think the boat even had a full tank of diesel.
You gave him a job, basically, and they got to own their own business, just like every American aspires to.
Let them keep their jobs, absolutely. My objective for the first year when I was in the Philippines was to meet people. And I went, I found out where directors and producers from the Philippine film community hung out. I went, and that's where I hung out. I met the only American casting director in the Philippine Islands. His name is Ken Metcalf, still a good friend of mine today. And so when the films did start coming over, I had my foot in the door. And so anyway, I walked right onto my buddy, my casting director friend, got me a couple of Filipino movies where I was the American farm implement salesperson who would come over and sell farm implements from America to the Filipinos. Then here came Apocalypse Now. I went right to work on Apocalypse Now. I worked for a year on Apocalypse Now. Before Apocalypse Now was finished, a little film being directed by Sidney J. Fury. He's a Canadian director that lives in Hollywood now. He's a transplant from Canada, but he's a great director, and I love the guy. And he is the one that discovered Degutty. And I give him all the credit. It was not Stanley Kubrick that discovered me. It was Sidney J. Fury. And it was because of Sidney J. Fury that I got to work on that I got to work on Full Metal Jacket, actually.
Well, I want to tell
the
that.
Name
I want
of the
you
film
to...
was Boys in Company C. Then I went back and did another one a couple of years later with Sidney J. Fury again in the Philippines called Purple Hearts.
Well, I want you to tell the story because there's an interesting story about how you managed to get into Full Metal Jacket in really one of the starring roles, the one that everybody remembers. But let's do that in just a moment. I'm talking to Gunnery Sergeant Arlie Ermey, the author of Gunny's Rules. You should go out and pick up the book. Hand it to an unmotivated person in your family for Christmas. It'd be the best gift they ever got, and it'd probably set them on the straight and narrow and get them squared away, as the gunny says. Back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. My guest, and I'm so pleased to have him here, is Gunnery Sergeant Arlie Ermey, and his brand-new book is called Gunny's Rules. Gunnery Sergeant Ermey, let me ask you about this. There is I thought it was a fantastic story of how you were originally recruited to be the technical advisor to tell, you know, the folks putting together Full Metal Jacket, Stanley Kubrick, how to get all the technical details right, but you were bound and determined to get one role in that movie, and despite the fact that it had already been assigned to somebody, you landed it. Will you please tell that story?
Well, yeah. Stanley called me up out of the clear blue sky one day, and I was working on a nuclear power plant. I was quality assurance swing shift supervisor, and Stanley Kubrick, one afternoon, the phone rang, and I picked it up, and lo and behold, it was Stanley Kubrick on the other end. And he told me that the way he got my phone number was he watched all the Vietnam War shows, and I kept popping up. And I'd worked for Sidney J. Fury for a couple of films. He was director of the Boys in Company C and Purple Hearts. So Stanley called up Sidney, and Sidney gave him my phone number. And Stanley reached out to me. He asked me, the first question he asked me was, had I read the novel The Short Timers by Gustav Hasford? Well, I had. Not only had I read it recently, I was going back through and rereading the book again because it was very catchy, very interesting book. And I told him I had read it, but Stanley, there's a lot of inaccuracies, a lot of fictitious bullcrap in there. Right away, I had Stanley Kubrick's attention. What do you mean, fictitious bullcrap? And so I wrote him and outlined all of the inaccuracies in the book and pointed out how they could be taken care of, how the problems could be solved. And I sent it to him. It was about a 20-page document. He called me back a couple of days later and asked me if I would come and work for him as technical advisor on Full Metal Jacket. And I told him that I would, and basically, the reason that I agreed to go to work on Full Metal Jacket as technical advisor was simply so I could get my foot in the door I got over there, and one of the first things I told Stanley was I would like to audition for Gunnery Sergeant Hartman, and he point blank, he said, "I'm sorry, but it's already contracted. I already have a contract with an actor. It's all signed, sealed." So there's where we stand. Anyway, I was technical advisor, and one of my jobs that I created for myself was interviewing these background extras that were going to make up the recruit platoon that we were going to train. And I interviewed each and every one. And Stanley, I took their picture. I stood them up next to a yardstick, and I took their picture. And Stanley Kubrick, being the fanatic that he was, insisted that he had the final say on even his background extras, everything in his movie, every aspect of his movie he was in control of. That worked in my favor because, I'm on the set. I don't have very much free time to interview these people that are now going to be the background extras or the recruit platoon in Stanley's movie. So I'm on the set technical advising at lunch. I got a group of about 20 people that were applying for jobs to come in, and I would interview them. I stopped on my way back from the set in wardrobe, and I put the Smokey Bear on. I already had the uniform on, wore it every day. I put the Smokey Bear on, and I went, and when I confronted these youngsters, I explained to them that anybody, I would say, have a few unsavory things to say about their mothers, fathers, immediate family, and if anybody took a shot at me, they were automatically disqualified. They would not be hired. And I, at the same time, I thought to get Leon Vitale, who is Stanley's right-hand man, get him down there with a video camera, because Stanley's going to have a look at these people, right?
Yep.
Well, after I gave him the first dialogue for, "I am Gunnery Sergeant Hartman, I am your senior drill instructor," I gave him all that. Then I walked into him, and I approached each and every one of them as a drill instructor would, and I left that platoon in my wake was in total shambles.
These guys have got their pants around their knees, and they're. I mean, you do just what a lot of us have seen you do in the movie that finally resulted from this.
But I did it for an hour, and I noticed the reason I continued, and it got better and better as it went along, was I noticed after I talked, after I approached the first or second recruit, all of a sudden Leon was pointing the camera at me more than he was at the person that I was interviewing. So I knew that my plan was effective, it was working, and Stanley Kubrick was going to watch me audition whether he liked it or not. And I quit after going through all of them. The reason I finally quit was Leon ran out of tape in his video camera. But we sent that tape immediately to Stanley Kubrick. Matter of fact, Leon hand carried it up to Stanley. And next morning, I had the job.
Now, you walked in, and he knew what you had done, didn't he?
Of course. He had that wiry little grin on his face and said, you pulled it off. You rascal, you. He said, "Yeah, you're going to be Gunnery Sergeant Hartman. How much do you want?" And I said, "Stanley, you be fair with me." And I let him decide how much he was going to pay me.
Now, you also left in the detail that there's the young man who'd already been signed for that role, who would have been a pale comparison to you, he still got a job in the movie, didn't he? Because people know where
he still ended up being the door gunner.
Yeah.
Get some. And how do you kill women and children? You just don't lead them as much. And I went for years and years. I would never tell anybody, but it's not public record, so it's not a big deal.
Gunnery Sergeant Ermey, let's talk about bullying a bit. It's in the news a lot. You certainly, as a drill instructor, I guess you could be said to have bullied people, but in a sense, all you're doing is training them. And as you said, there are two things that people respond to, right?
That's right. Fear and pain. The greatest training tools in the world. But the thing is, my book is full of basically my opinions on the evolution of this country. And one of the great downfalls that I see, one of the failures of this country, is this bullying thing. I was bullied when I was a kid. Now, I guarantee you I punched his lights out so quick. You know what? If you defend yourself nowadays, you get in trouble. Why have we allowed the government to push us into this corner where we can't even stand up for ourselves anymore? They're not always there to rescue us. I mean, let's face it, if you don't stand up for yourself, scumbag, the guy's going to come back tomorrow. He's going to get stronger and tougher and eviler each and every time he approaches you. But I guarantee you, if you take things into your own hands, the very first time this guy comes up and starts bullying you and you smack him in the snot locker and you punch his lights out, he is not going to come back tomorrow.
That's
okay?
Right.
So this bullying thing, this is brought on by our government again, by the rules, the ridiculous rules that they pass.
Hey, listen, I'm talking to Gunnery Sergeant Arlie Ermey. His book is called The Gunny, and we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It is such a great pleasure to have with me Gunnery Sergeant Arlie Ermey, the only Marine to have been advanced in rank after he was medically retired from the Marines and years later. He is the author most recently of Gunny's Rules. And Gunnery Sergeant Ermey, let's talk about bullying a bit. It's in the news a lot, and I hear people saying we've got to have a program, we've got to keep kids from bullying each other. I got bullied in high school. I think I came out of it with a thicker skin as a result. Maybe that lets me do what I do today. You certainly, as a drill instructor, I guess you could be said to have bullied people, but in a sense, all you're doing is training them. And as you said, there are two things that people respond to, right?
That's right. Fear and pain. The greatest training tools in the world. But the thing is, my book is full of basically my opinions on the evolution of this country. And one of the great downfalls that I see, one of the failures of this country, is this bullying thing. I was bullied when I was a kid. Now, I guarantee you I punched his lights out so quick. You know what? If you defend yourself nowadays, you get in trouble. So why have we allowed the government to push us into this corner where we can't even stand up for ourselves anymore? They're not always there to rescue us. I mean, let's face it, if you don't stand up for yourself, scumbag, the wimp, if you want to be a wimp, the guy's going to come back tomorrow. He's going to get stronger and tougher and eviler each and every time he approaches you. But I guarantee you, if you take things into your own hands, the very first time this guy comes up and starts bullying you and you smack him in the snot locker and you punch his lights out, he is not going to come back tomorrow.
That's
okay?
Right.
So this bullying thing, this is brought on by our government again, by the rules, the ridiculous rules that they pass. Now they want to take our handguns away from us so that we're totally defenseless against anybody, the home invasions and things of that nature. They want to turn our boys, our young men, into passive little pussycats. And that is really a shame. That I see it this way. Everybody's a winner. Everybody gets a trophy nowadays, buddy. I mean, if you win or lose the game, you're going to get the same trophy. So why? Now, why should these kids even bother to show up for training? Why should they bother to show up to learn how to kick the soccer ball? Hell, they're going to get the same trophy the other team gets, regardless of whether they win or lose, and there are no losers nowadays. We know that. Now, how are kids ever going to learn how to cope with losing, though? That's what I want to know, because we're very competitive, you know. And kids are very competitive, too. So all of a sudden, they're 18 years old, they go for their first job interview, and they don't get the job. They have just lost for the first time in their life. What are they going to do?
Well, if they've read your book,
bullying, now we're into suicide, because the suicide, young people's suicide rate today is higher than it's ever been. Gee, I wonder why.
Yep.
Maybe we should have taught little Junior how to cope with the thought that everybody can't win in the first place. And he wouldn't have had to resort to this terrible thing called suicide. Nothing is earned. It's always given. Why should little Johnny even put out any effort if he's going to get the same paycheck that you do, and you're over there busting your hump? Why should he even bother showing up to work? He's going to get the same paycheck. Let you do all the work. Now, what message are we sending to our children? Here's the message that we're sending. Shut up. Get in step, comrade. And that is the message, folks. I do not want to be living. I don't want to be a socialist. I don't want to live in a socialist country. I fought for this country. I spent 12 years in the Marine Corps defending this country. By God, we better stand up for ourselves, and we better quit. Make these people that work especially just for the establishment, we better wake them up. They don't work for the establishment, folks. They don't work for the party. They work for you and I. We pay their wages. Let's fire them all. Start over again. That's the only way we can clean this mess up.
And your position is everybody can be a winner if they simply apply themselves and decide that they're going to win no matter what, like you did with Stanley Kubrick.
Like I said, if I didn't have a job, if I was fired today, guaranteed by the end of the week I'd have a decent job.
There's
it would
only
pay the bills. It would feed the family. We couldn't go on vacations in Spain or Italy. But I guarantee you, they would stay, be warm and dry, and they would have a roof over their head, and they would be fed.
And you don't
might as well be me,
Gunnery Sergeant Irby. You don't just work for Hollywood, for television, for a book. You also go out and spend a fair amount of your time volunteering to go out, not just overseas, but here in the States, on behalf of your comrades in uniform.
Well, my months off. I take 2 months off a year, November and December. And then November, I speak at Marine Corps birthday balls, and I do usually about 10 or 12. And in December, I do Toys for Tots. So I basically, those 2 months are basically there for me to get my head screwed on right.
Gunnery Sergeant Irby, I've taken enough of your time. I really appreciate you coming on to talk about your stories, about your success, and I hope we've inspired a few people to get out there and get squared away. They should pick up a copy of Gunny's Rules, and it's a real pleasure to have you on, and thank you very much for your service to America.
Well, I've been there, done that, just about every situation you could ever imagine. I just talk about the things that are troubling this country. And I like to think that maybe in some cases, if some people find themselves in situations, they could get a little inspiration from, I've been there, done that, you know. And thank you. Thank the good Lord for looking after us all. And bless you. Thanks for sharing your airtime with me today.
The book is called Gunny's Rules. Its author is the Gunny, Gunnery Sergeant Irby Irby, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your calls a bit later at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. Just this past weekend, I was at an event. I ran into a number of veterans. I thanked them for their service. And when we're hit up by veterans groups asking for a donation or to get time on the air, we're always glad to accommodate them because, well, generally, we all support veterans, and we want to make sure that those people who have served the country get the kind of thank you that they should get. And very rarely do we hear about cases, although apparently they do happen, of stolen valor or where people take advantage of a situation and claim that they are veterans or that they represent a veterans organization. The case that I want to talk to with Daniel Fromson, who's the editor of the New Yorker magazine and has written for the New York Times and the Atlantic,
about a guy by the name, well, one of his names is Bobby Charles Thompson. Mr. Thompson, thanks so much for taking the time to talk about this case today, because I think it takes more than just a couple of minutes to explain who Bobby Charles Thompson was.
I think you're exactly right about that. And I'm not sure exactly how much time we have, but I'll do my best to get started.
All right. Where should we start with it? I'll tell you what. Let's, as you in the piece you wrote for the Atlantic or for the Washingtonian, you kind of left for the end what his real background was. But who did he portray when he said that he was representing the United States Navy Veterans Association?
Sure. Well, Lars, I think basically the best place to start there is that the first thing to say is that he actually did start this U.S. Navy Veterans Association, which was a huge veterans organization, a nonprofit registered in Washington with all of these state chapters around the country. And it operated for about a decade, a little bit less. And while running it, he said his name was Bobby Charles Thompson, that he was a retired naval commander with the Navy Reserve, and basically presented himself also as a somewhat, I would say, well-connected figure in Washington, and was really spent a lot of time schmoozing and attending various fundraisers around the country, so kind of building up this aura of influence around himself. What was interesting was that he had all kinds of sort of cryptic stories about his past, about he sometimes claimed to have been an intelligence officer. He referred in vague ways to different sorts of secret missions of that sort. But, you know, the actual details about his past were sort of far and few between. So he, all people really knew was that he was this, you know, big naval commander who seemed to be doing good work for vets. And the other thing that was interesting was that he presented in person as being quite eccentric, and he would wear these sort of shabby suits and had a very dramatic pompadour hairstyle. So he didn't look like your average guy, but people figured he was just eccentric and that he did have this huge organization that was quite influential.
Well, and by the way, he did, when you said he presented himself as being well-connected, based on the pictures of this man, Bobby Charles Thompson, the man who called himself that, he had pictures of himself with presidents, with President George W. Bush, with Karl Rove, with former House Speaker John Boehner, with John McCain. So he had, and Rudy Giuliani. So he had pictures of himself with some of the most admired figures, especially on the right, in conservative politics. So he could present himself as being well-connected, at least based on his photo page.
That's correct. Yeah, he it's sort of interesting because he inhabited this strange space of what it actually is in some ways. His story is a little bit of a example or even parable of politics these days, where he didn't actually serve, for instance, as, say, a policy advisor or somebody who really worked in Washington. But because of his substantial donations, which were certainly tens of thousands and really, I think, about hundreds of thousands of dollars, although the exact figure is hard to pin down, he was able to have all these opportunities to meet really the who's who of the Republican Party, particularly during the George W. Bush era and slightly after. So you had this situation where then it kind of becomes this feedback loop where as soon as he has a couple of photos and is being invited to a couple of fundraisers, you're on the circuit, you know, and then he's able to really, particularly the people who are not in the circuit, present as being this quite influential guy. So, yes, he did. You're correct. You know, posed for photos with all these people. He visited the White House. There are somewhat unconfirmed reports that he actually met George W. Bush in the Oval Office for a more personal opportunity. There's quite a lot of rumors that swirl around, those activities. But yes, he really, for being somebody who was living under what turned out to be a stolen identity, it was pretty remarkable.
And how much in all totaled, how much did he manage to raise?
The figure that's thrown around is about $100 million over, I think it's 8 years. And the important thing to note there, though, is that the way the organization, this veterans organization, functioned was that they outsourced virtually all of their fundraising to telemarketers. And so the telemarketers may have raised about $100 million, but the vast majority of that actually was taken in by the telemarketers because they had quite lucrative fundraising contracts that that enabled them to keep a majority of what they raised. That's not necessarily typical for your everyday nonprofit, but there are a lot of organizations that do function that way. And sort of whether or not you think that's ethical, is a subject of lots of controversy and discussion, sort of beyond the purview of my article. But that was sort of how it operated. So at the end of the day, he may have, just doing a back of the envelope calculation, let's say about $10 million or a little more actually went to Bobby Charles Thompson. And then what happened to that money at that point is really unclear, because only a small portion of the money was officially accounted for later on, because he ended up being investigated out of the state of Ohio. So because the investigation that ultimately sorted out what happened with the nonprofit took place on the state level, there are hundreds of thousands of dollars that are not accounted for.
I'm talking to Daniel Frumson, who's the author most recently of The Strange Spectacular Con of Bobby Charles Thompson. Is it fair to say that you at least suspect that a lot of that money was used by Bobby Charles Thompson as contributions to politicians to further his scam?
It's fair to say that a substantial chunk of the money probably went to politicians. But whether that's 5% or 10% or 50% is very hard to say, because, again, a huge amount of this money is unaccounted for. And so it really is speculation. However, one thing that's fascinating, I will say, about Bobby Charles Thompson is that while he was running this, this huge veterans organization, although it existed primarily on paper and not in reality, and while he was attending these Washington fundraisers, he did not personally live lavishly, which is one of the great puzzles, actually, of his case. You figure most people who are eventually charged with stealing millions of dollars would at least have a nice house or fancy cars or some other sort of vice or at least hobby that they would be spending a lot of money on. But in his case, he was revealed to be living in, a really evidently run-down duplex in a not very great part of Tampa. And, again, he didn't have particularly nice clothes. He didn't seem to be spending money on anything else, really, other than these political donations. Or perhaps the money went elsewhere. And some people also talk about, maybe he has $5 million stashed away that nobody's found. There are all kinds of theories. But he certainly didn't live in a lavish way. So this is quite unusual.
I'm talking to Daniel Frumson, who's the author of a great piece about Bobby Charles Thompson. We'll be back to continue this conversation in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to have with me Daniel Frumson. And Daniel pointed out that I had misidentified him, the position you now hold as a writer and as an editor.
Yes, that's right. It's at the New York Times Magazine now. I'm one of the editors there.
And, of course, you've written for The Atlantic and a number of other major publications. And we're talking about the piece you most recently wrote about a man who called himself Bobby Charles Thompson. And we've talked about the estimated $100 million that he raised for what was called the United States Navy Veterans Association, about how the vast majority of the money likely went to telemarketers who helped raise the money for the organization. Let me ask you this, is there any indication that those telemarketers had any idea that this thing was not benefiting veterans to any great degree, but it was primarily set up, apparently, to benefit the man who called himself Bobby Charles Thompson?
That's a very good question. And I think that the main thing I can say about the telemarketers involved is that the trial that, ultimately took place, which sorted out all these allegations, the telemarketers, for the most part, were not part of it. And what I can say is, I think that there probably was some degree of scrutiny, but it's unclear how much on the part of the telemarketers. But also, I think what's important to say more generally is to give some sense of just how elaborate and I think hard to penetrate the kind of facade of normalcy within the the nonprofit actually was. Because, again, this is, you know, even though it turned out to basically be run by one person, this was an organization that filed tax returns with the federal government, had a headquarters and more than 40 state chapters that were also independently registered and, you know, filing tax returns and so forth. This was an organization that actually, remarkably at one point, had a state chapter that was audited by the IRS. And it did turn out to be, I guess, a sort of training audit where there was a trainee involved. But nonetheless, it passed the audit. So this is a really, really elaborate organization. So I think that to give the telemarketers the benefit of the doubt, you could imagine that there might be a scenario in which there would be some degree of scrutiny about whether this was a legitimate organization or not. And unless these people were doing really thorough independent due diligence on paper and with a quick meeting in person, it might look perfectly legitimate.
Well,
that said,
yeah, go ahead.
Hard to know. Oh, I'm just saying, you know, that said, the kind of corporate fundraising world is quite controversial, and there have been instances of various fundraisers accused by state attorney generals of malpractice and so forth. But, you know, there hasn't been a sort of independent truth, an independent case into whether that happened here or not.
I'm talking to Daniel Fromson. And Daniel, we've talked about certainly a number of times on my program, various charities. And it is one of the great, conundrums that there are charities who will tell you, well, if we don't spend 50% or 60% or 70% on fundraising, there's no way we can raise the kind of money that we do for the cause. I find that, you know, unpersuasive, because I know plenty of charities who are proud that they keep their administrative costs and fundraising costs extraordinarily low, and they tell you, we're going to put either nearly all or all of the money into whatever cause it is that we're addressing. So let's talk about the cause. Did the man who called himself Bobby Charles Thompson give anything to real veterans?
There are at least several instances of actual military or veterans groups that did receive some money. There isn't a lot of evidence of this. So, I mean, we're talking about maybe tens of thousands of dollars, a couple of years. And I think, if I recall correctly, that, those actual donations seem to have ramped up toward the end of the charity's kind of lifespan, where it was under scrutiny, so it had a greater need to prove that it was legitimate. That said, one interesting thing here, although it doesn't, I won't go so far as saying that the organization was wholly legitimate, but there is a little bit of arguably wiggle room here, because one of the sort of fascinating things about the nonprofit is that, and we can talk more about kind of the unmasking of Bobby Charles Thompson as who he really was, but later on, you know, in the course of kind of this process of discovering his real identity and ultimately his being tried, he did claim that actually the press and others have fundamentally misunderstood what the purpose of the U.S. Navy Veterans Association was, and that to characterize it as a group that was, for instance, a charity isn't actually quite correct. It was registered as a nonprofit veterans organization. So while it might involve charitable activities, it wasn't strictly set up to just be a charity. He claimed that it actually was served as sort of more of a political propaganda organ, that this was really something that arose in the wake of September 11th and during the Bush years to promote the interests of the political right. You can really debate whether that was the case, whether this is a very convenient defense. But if, in fact, that was what it was set up to do, then you can see why he actually might not have had to spend as much money as people thought he would have on veterans themselves. And so this is a really, again, gets into a real gray area. But to answer your immediate question, it's pretty clear that the kind of money that most people expected was going to veterans was not going to veterans.
Well, and if he was going to do lobbying beyond just meeting up with, John Boehner or John McCain or George Bush at various grip and grin photo opportunities, is there any evidence he did any of that work?
Lobbying work, you mean?
Yeah, lobbying work or advocating for pieces of legislation or perhaps even finding out about the problems in the Veterans Administration, something that might have actually helped the veterans in some way.
Well, he did actually engage in some lobbying, and this is another one of these complicated areas where, you know, evidently My understanding, although I'm no expert in this, is that he may have engaged in lobbying activities that sort of were beyond the purview of what a nonprofit organization of this sort is supposed to engage in. Although one can debate whether he was acting independently, you know, in other words, not as a private citizen rather than as a representative of the group. But he did, I think the most famous and best case of him doing some lobbying was he hired a couple of people to act as lobbyists in Virginia and evidently tried and succeeded at having a bill passed that would make it easier for the U.S. Navy Veterans Association to fundraise in Virginia.
I'm talking to Daniel Fromson about his amazing story about the man who called himself Bobby Charles Thompson. When we come back in just a moment, I'd love to have him tell us the story of how Bobby Charles Thompson finally met his end, well, at least the end of his criminal career, and was finally brought to court and tried on the charges that he was accused of. We'll get back to you in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll get back to your calls later. You can always email talk@LarsLarson.com and follow us on Twitter @LarsLarsonShow and on Facebook @TheLarsLarsonShow. I'm talking to Daniel Fromson, who's written this fantastic story about a man who called himself Bobby Charles Thompson, ran what he called the United States Navy Veterans Association, that was not quite a charity, not quite a lobbying group, maybe a political propaganda group, but that gathered in about $100 million, perhaps as much as $10 million of it, ended up in the pockets of the man named Bobby Charles Thompson. And let's talk about who he really was, because he did have a background with the United States military, didn't he?
Yes, that's correct. Well, so there's quite a long saga of, you know, to give the basic data points here. He spent, you know, almost a decade running this nonprofit organization, and then the Tampa Bay Times, the local newspaper, basically exposed the organization as a fraud insofar as it couldn't find any real officers or members of the group other than Bobby Charles Thompson. And so he went on the run and was ultimately indicted out of the state of Ohio. And when this happens, there is just a real fascinating kind of unraveling of layers and layers where it becomes clear, first of all, that Bobby Charles Thompson is a real identity, but it is not this man's identity. He stole the, or at least was using, but you know, he was alleged to have stolen the name and identifying information, such as social security number and so forth, of a man living in Washington State who was unrelated to the U.S. Navy Veterans Association. So then there are more and more of these other identities that pop up over a nearly 2-year period or about a year and a half while he is on the run. And so he's finally arrested in Portland, Oregon. And at this point, it's a really bizarre situation because he's arrested with, you know, he has all of these different IDs and actually 3 different wallets literally on his person with different identities in them. And there's you know, all kinds of sort of disguises and fake or at least non-prescription glasses and the whole thing. So he turns out to be somebody who, interestingly enough, still has a great deal of mystery surrounding him. But eventually he is identified as being somebody who has actually been a fugitive for several decades. His real name is John Cody, John Donald Cody. And as you pointed out, Lars, he does have a military background, but not with the Navy. He had served with the Army Reserve, and not just with the Army Reserve, but as an intelligence officer. And not just as an Army Reserve intelligence officer, but he would eventually claim that he had actually worked for the CIA for quite a long time. And what gets really interesting there is that there actually is some evidence that if not for his whole career, but for a brief period of time, he may have been affiliated with the CIA. So it gets quite murky again in its own way, even when you figure out who he really is. But he does have this real life sort of, if not total secret agent persona, at least military intelligence persona.
Well, before we go on with that, would you mind sketching out the circumstances in which the man calling himself Bobby Charles Thompson was in, both the cash he had available to him, but the place where he was living when the federal marshals finally arrived?
Sure. Well, in terms of circumstances, everything we know about him was that he at no point really seems to have lived quite lavishly or spent much money on himself. But so when he was arrested, he was living in a home in a sort of blue collar neighborhood in Portland, Montevilla. And it was in the home of a woman who basically rented out rooms via Craigslist and so forth. So I think at any given point in time, she would have three or four roommates. And I've been to the house. It's quite pleasant, perfectly nice, well-decorated house. It's, not the kind of place that you would expect necessarily. At this point, he's, I believe, in his 60s. So, an older man who had hundreds of thousands of dollars stashed away, you wouldn't expect him to be living there, probably.
Nope.
But at the same time, it's kind of a, sort of a perfect spot to lie low if you think about it. And I remember it's pretty funny. His landlady, said to me, it turned out that he was a felon on the run, or had been indicted on several felonies at least. I think a friend had told her, or she had this philosophy that every person who opts for this kind of living arrangement, there's always a reason. There's always, some sort of personal crisis, or they're down on their luck, or they just prefer a kind of eccentric living situation. But she said, there's always a reason. So in this case, the reason turned out to be that he was a wanted man. It was kind of an unlikely spot for him to be.
Did she get any kind of inkling that there was something beyond that other reason that people have, that you could understand where somebody going through a divorce or separated from their family or whatever might not want to share a lot? Did she get some inkling of what this guy was all about?
I think he only lived there for, I think, under 2 months. So she didn't get to know him really well. But I will say that, there were a couple of unusual moments where I think, she had a sense that he was maybe a little bit more worldly than he looked. But for instance, over time, she sort of had the sense that he knew bits of a couple of foreign languages, and he little things that suggested that he was a little bit more sophisticated. But he did have a backstory that made sense. That's another thing, she told me when we spoke. She said, I always look for people who have a story that makes sense. And his story made sense. And his story was that, actually, as you just brought up, that he had come out of a divorce that was a really messy divorce. He had moved from a Native American reservation in the Pacific Northwest, or at least in Montana, down to Oregon. And that he was a retired law enforcement officer living off a couple of pensions. It sort of just it made sense to her. And he provided references, although the references were a little bit odd in the sense that one of them, he said, was a distant cousin, but he said, don't call him unless I'm dead. So, that could have raised some eyebrows. But again, she was used to renting to people who, whose lives were falling apart, who were under unusual circumstances. So it didn't seem that unusual to her.
Now, was he surprised to finally be caught, or was there sort of a sense of inevitability?
This is a good question. And I can't tell you exactly, because I think the only person who knows that is him, is John Cody, who now is in prison in Ohio. But what I can tell you from the sense I got from law enforcement officers who ultimately were present for the arrest is that there was it was kind of eerie. So he was arrested by a group of U.S. Marshals and local police officers who were kind of deputized on the Marshals Task Force. And what one of the marshals said to me, he said, before every arrest like this, we kind of anticipate how it's going to play out, right? And I don't think they thought that he was going to turn violent, but there was a sense that, usually when marshals or police officers surround a suspect, the person says, hey, why are you arresting me? Or maybe they become a little combative but it's usually not a super quiet and calm affair. Right. In this case, basically they followed him back to his house one night, and while he was fumbling for his keys on the sort of stoop or outside the home, they arrested him. And what the marshal said was it was quite strange because he just sort of looked up and he didn't really say anything except that he was going to plead. Basically, he said, I take the fifth. I'm not going to say anything. And he was totally calm. And the marshal sort of said that they joked afterward that it actually fit everything else they knew about the guy because he was so professional and calm, even when he was being arrested, that it was as if he did expect it, but also like he wasn't going to make a scene. You know, it was just like, it was just another day of doing business, even being arrested.
I'm talking to Daniel Frumps, and we're going to continue this conversation in just a moment. We'll be back, and I really appreciate you being with me. If you want to email, it's talk@LarsLarsen.com, and you're listening to The Lars Larsen Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larsen Show. It's a great pleasure to be with you and to have with me Daniel Frumson, who's written a really, truly fascinating story about a guy who called himself Bobby Charles Thompson, managed to, I think we can say fraudulently, he's in sitting in prison, raise $100 million, of which a fraction, perhaps $10 million, went to him under the guise of what he called the United States Navy Veterans Association. He was, in fact, a veteran, but not a Navy veteran. There is some indication he worked for the CIA at one point and had been in the United States Army. And Daniel Frumson's been telling his story, so we left off with his arrest at a, we couldn't call it a boarding house, but a woman who rented rooms in her home to people who would live in, fairly ordinary circumstances, and you might even call it meager circumstances, a few hundred dollars a month to rent a room, even though he had literally hundreds of thousands of dollars on him. How did the authorities finally get on to the man calling himself Bobby Charles Thompson?
It's an interesting saga, but basically the short version, how they got onto him, again, you know, there were some news stories early on saying that the organization was a fraud. And basically, as he's on the run, they're kind of following this thread of these different identities that he's living under. So it was really as different names that seemed to be affiliated with him popped up that were, again, you know, the identities of real people, but ones that he had allegedly stolen. They were able to follow this thread. And it turned out that a large number of these people whose identities were used had some affiliation to Native American tribes or reservations. And it's unclear exactly how he acquired these identities. But basically, this is actually, on one hand, it was quite smart because he stole the identities of people who, as one of the marshals put it, basically, you know, a lot of Native Americans, they don't move around too often. They don't necessarily have reason to check their credit reports as often as a lot of people, especially if they're living in like federally provided housing and so forth. So, but what it also meant was that if the name of a Native American popped up in an unlikely location, and if it was an unusual name, then it was probably him and not the real Native American. So what ultimately got them to Portland was there was a name that popped up, Anderson Yazzie. And there are only, I think, two real Anderson Yazzies, and they both live in the Southwest and are Native Americans. So they were able to follow him when that name popped up in Portland. You know, then fast forward to the arrest, of course, you know, they learned quite a lot more. And that's the point at which after he's arrested and he's sitting in jail, they figure out basically just on a hunch, really, that he is actually John Cody. And then, you know, it kind of spirals outward from there.
Now, tell me this. In terms of disguises, you said he's caught with all this money. He has the resources to do what he wants to do in terms of disguising himself. He has disguises, including, you know, plain glasses or what would appear to be prescription glasses so that he can disguise himself that way. But that pompadour never really went away, did it?
Yeah, that's sort of one of the funny details is it's, you know, he cut the hair and it was less dramatic, but there was an, you know, it was also a little bit more subtle than the pompadour itself. It's pretty well known, or at least, you know, claimed that at some point he had some hair implants or other plastic surgery. So there's an aspect to his hairline too that doesn't really go away, even if the hair is short. That's somewhat distinctive.
That's got to be an amazing thing for a police officer. I mean, you're right. An awful lot of officers have to do a lot of, you know, burn a lot of shoe leather to find people who are good at hiding themselves. And in this case, he could have hidden himself much more effectively with changes in physical look and everything else. But It sounds as though he didn't, but he had hit himself with the names. And despite having run this, you know, as you described it, this very elaborate organization that filed paperwork with both state agencies and federal agencies and even survived an IRS audit, that at the end of the day, he gets caught because he uses a very unusual name, you know, to identify himself in a new town, which seems as though that's a major slip up for a guy who's been very good at running a very tight ship all along.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it was quite strange. I think that the marshals are in agreement with you that it was really the names that slipped them up. And you know, as I think one of them put it to me once, you know, like if he had called himself, you know, John L. Smith or whatever, they would have never found him, you know? The thing here was, you know, the question is, you know, what is the fact that he used those names say about him? And I think the, you know, one thing that's a recurring trope when people talk about their sensitive personality is, you know, an element of narcissism, an element of thinking that he was really smart and could never be caught. So it's possible that he just thought, yeah, like I can use these unusual names and I'm so slick that no one will ever get onto it. It's also possible. Another sense of the marshals had, though, was that he did become a little bit sloppier over time. And I mean, he seemed to, for one thing, be a heavy drinker. He was using IDs at the time that he was arrested that were really obvious fakes. I mean, they had typos. They didn't, you know, use some of the holograms and other sorts of things that would be a clear signifier for an actual ID. So I think that the names thing is interesting because it in some ways can be read as evidence of his ultimate decline and sloppiness that after a very long run, remember, you know, ultimately about 3 decades of being a fugitive, he kind of tripped himself up as he was getting older.
Daniel Frumson has written for New York, The Atlantic, and The New York Times. It is a great pleasure to have you on the program, and congratulations on a really fascinating story.
Thank you again so much. It was a pleasure to be here, and best of luck with your own stories.
Take care now. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.